Welcome to another episode of Reliability Matters. This is our fourth episode. In our first episode, we featured an interview with SMT guru Bob Willis. In episode two, we spoke with failure analysis investigators Eric Camden and Paco Solis about their experiences solving reliability issues in the field. In episode three, we spoke with Johns Hopkins University's Applied Physics Laboratories engineer Wendy Kasker about her successful effort to switch their space customers' cleaning process from a solvent base to an aqueous base, improving cleanliness, safety, and environmental impact. Coming up, we have several terrific interviews with very interesting individuals, including ITM Consulting's Phil Zaro and Jim Hall. You're going to get a kick out of these guys. Soon also, we'll be speaking with Rockwell Collins, now Collins Aerospace, Doug Pauls, discussing the new IPC J Standard 001 G Amendment 1 and the new cleanliness assessment requirements for objective evidence. What does that mean for you? We'll be discussing that soon, so stay tuned. On this fourth episode, I thought it would be a good idea to review the contents of a recent webinar we released last week. The title of the webinar is Improving Reliability of Circuit Assemblies in Harsh Environments. Here's the podcast version of the webinar. If you prefer webinar slides that you can actually see, you can visit aqueoustech.com, click on the Tech Tuesday link. Otherwise, if you prefer to hear the podcast version, then sit down, relax, get comfortable, and we'll begin right now.
Welcome to Reliability Matters, a podcast for the electronic assembly industry. Each episode covers topics related to reliability, best practices, and environmentally responsible assembly techniques, with insights from experts across the electronic assembly industry. Now, here's your host, Mike Conrad.
All right, here, we're going to get started. Once upon a time, we cleaned all circuit assemblies, and that is just a fact. And the times when we cleaned pretty much every circuit assembly was prior to 1989. There's a line in the sand in the electronics assembly industry, and that was everything before 1989 and everything after 1989. So what happened in 1989? The U.S. and originally 11 other countries, now every United Nations member country, ratified the Montreal Protocol, which was a treaty to ban certain chlorinated fluorocarbons, CFCs, or chemicals containing CFCs. The number one method of cleaning circuit assemblies prior to 1989 was through solvents, 111 trichloroethane, Freon TMS, and a bunch of generic versions of those, almost all of them containing CFCs, which were going to be on a 10-year phase-out by 1999. So that created a dilemma. The industry needed to clean their boards if they were going to continue to use the fluxes and soon to be derived solder paste that they have been using. But of course, necessity is the mother of invention, and out came so-called no clean flux. No clean promised a elimination of a complete process step. And that would be to eliminate cleaning altogether by using a flux that did not require cleaning. It was fairly inert, and it could, its minor residues could stay on the board and not harm them. And if you were in the military business or space electronics or medical electronics, you kept cleaning. You just switched to a different type of flux and you just kept cleaning, or you used the same type of flux and changed your cleaning process either way. But for the vast majority of assemblers, which is consumer grade electronics, which represent the majority of electronics produced today. And then you just got rid of the cleaning process and switched to no clean flux. So what happened when we stopped removing flux? What happened when we stopped removing flux is we stopped removing everything. And I'm going to make that a bolder statement. We stopped removing everything. And if I can detract for just a moment and get a little bit opinionated. I try not to be too opinionated in these things because I'm no one died and left me in charge. But instead of referring to a defluxing process, rethink that. You know, we buy a defluxing machine, we fill it with defluxing chemical, and we run a defluxing process. I would suggest that we take that mindset and modify it slightly and just consider it a cleaning process, because the flux is only one of the ingredients we're trying to remove, one of the contaminant species we're trying to remove. And while I'm still on an opinion roll, get the word no clean out of your head. No clean, people read no clean on a label as an instruction rather than an adjective. It really is not no clean. It really is low residue. It could be no clean if you can leave, if your board can tolerate that low residue, but it's not always no clean. So consider, if you're running a quote no clean flux, consider it that it's really just a low residue flux, which may be able to be left on the assembly and may not be able to be left on the assembly. So when we're removing flux, when we're running the quote unquote defluxing process, which I prefer to call a cleaning process, obviously our target is flux. But there are also a host of what I like to call usual suspect residues on the assembly. And they come from the assembly process itself. They come from humans who touch the boards. They come from the component fabrication part of the business, and they come from board fabrication. Boards have a host of contaminant species on them when you get them, before you even populate them. From a board fabrication standpoint, there are etch residues, developer chemicals, water quality rinses for the inner layers and the outer layers, Hassel fluids and final rinses, alkaline cleaners are frequently used, and they could leave residues behind. On the component fabrication front, there are plating bath residues, water quality rinses, deflashing chemicals, mold release agents, pre-plating oxide cleaning is done on the components and may leave residues, pre-tinning flux residues. A lot of components now are re-tinned to go back to lead if it's like a military application, and they can leave residues behind as well. Several years ago at the IPC SMTA Cleaning and Coating Conference in Chicago, which happens every 2 years, it just happened a few months ago, Research in Motion, the BlackBerry folks showed up and talked about an issue they had that required cleaning to solve the issue. Now, if you are a phone manufacturer, a mobile phone manufacturer, you have a huge economy of scale and you can afford to tweak your process to avoid certain process steps and capitalize on the sheer scale of your assembly process. They had an issue. They didn't clean their boards. Most cell phone companies don't. Again, because they have this huge economy of scale, they're able to control a process and choose materials that might avoid the need for cleaning and then save millions of dollars in the process. But BlackBerry had to clean, they had to rescue clean a whole bunch of components. It turned out they had a particular component that would not wet to the board. It was repelling the solder. And upon investigation, they determined that there was mold release on the component reels, and the mold release transferred to the board. And if you really want to mess up someone's day, put a little silicone around a solder joint and watch the solder repel from it. So they had to rescue clean a whole bunch of components in order to solder them properly to the board. Just an example of stowaway residues from other processes. And then we have the assembly process. That's where we intentionally put contaminant species on the board in the form of flux cleaning chemicals, and if they are, parts of them are cleaned earlier in the process. All sorts of contaminant species are intentionally added during and unintentionally added during the assembly process. Then we have the human contaminants. I like to call it the Dorito effect. After breaks and after lunch, somehow boards get dirtier. We tend to put moisturizers and hand sanitizers on our body, on our hands, and then touch the boards because we're not always wearing finger cuts. And that transfers to the board as well and can affect reliability in the future. So flux is really just the icing on the cake. It sits above human residues, assembly residues, component fabrication residues, and board fabrication residues. One of the problems that we have, one of the great achievements that we've made in the electronic assembly business, is miniaturization. We now have, you know, supercomputers in our back pocket. And in order to do that, we miniaturize the board so they can fit in small packages. We miniaturize the components so we can put many of them within that small package. And we have now effectively decreased the gap between anodes and cathodes. The bridge between, the dielectric properties between conducting forces is minimized to the point where there is very little visible dielectric real estate on the board that allows proper resistivity between polar opposites. So when we take our boards and then we fill them with residue, which we always have historically, we've just used to clean it. We have all these different forms of usual suspect residues on the assembly and a very small space that all this residue is crammed into. We're just creating a breeding ground for dendritic growth and parasitic leakage and other forms of electrochemical migration, which we'll get into in a moment. Electrochemical migration does not occur the moment the contaminants are put on the board. It takes time, and that time could be months or sometimes even years before electrochemical migration could manifest into a failure mechanism. So let's talk about electrochemical migration. Electrochemical migration is the process of laying conductive materials over insulating materials, resulting in a reduction of resistivity, or in its most dramatic sense, electrical shorts. So ECM starts with, in its worst case, an electrical short, which causes a component to fail or a part of the board circuitry to overheat, which can lead and does lead to dramatic situations like this, like a fire. And of course, circuit boards are usually inside something. So whatever device is containing them shares in the drama and can result in a catastrophic failure. There are several types of ECM failure mechanisms. I'll describe what they are and then we'll go into them in a little bit more detail. ECM failure mechanisms include dendritic growth. That's the one that produces the drama. Dendrite is a word from the Greek dendron, which means tree, or dendrites, which means tree-like. Obviously, dendrites and dendrite are very similar in spelling and pronunciation, that's where the name dendrite came from. It does resemble the branches, the stalk and the branches of a tree, only these are metal branches and metal stumps, and they are conductive. Another type of ECM failure mechanism is parasitic leakage. We'll get into that in just a moment. And then another type of ECM failure mechanism is CAF, conductive anodic filament. I like to call it CAF with two F, C-A-F-F, because it almost always ends in failure. So conductive anodic filament failure. So it takes three factors. There are three ingredients to produce the possibility of electrochemical migration. They are electrical current, conductive residues, and moisture. Absent any one of these, no ECM. These three factors in the right combination, ECM will follow. Harsh environments affects the amount of conductive residue and moisture required to develop into an ECM mechanism. So the harsher the environment, the less conductive material and actually the less electrical current to produce a failure mechanism related to electrochemical migration. So we're going to talk a little bit about harsh environments in this case in just a little bit. So of the three ECM-related failure mechanisms, dendritic growth, parasitic leakage, and CAF, we'll start with dendritic growth. That is the one that is most common to assemblers' experiences and certainly is the most dramatic. First, let's knock something out of the park here. Is dendritic growth the same thing as tin whiskers? I get asked this everywhere I go, and the answer is no. Completely different phenomenons. Metal whiskers differ from metallic dendrites in several respects. Dendrites are fern-shaped and they grow across the surface of the metal, while metal whiskers are hair-like and project perpendicularly to the surface. Dendrites require moisture capable of dissolving the metal into a solution of metal ions, which are then redistributed by electromigration in the presence of an electromagnetic field. Tin whisker formation doesn't require any dilution of metal or the presence of an electromagnetic field. So the pictures that you see below are illustrations of, or photographs of, tin whiskers. Compare that to dendritic growth. Dendrites are completely different. Although they can produce a similar failure mechanism, a short, they are different in how they form and the requirements to form them. As I said earlier, it takes three factors to produce an ECM failure mechanism, including dendritic growth, and that would be electrical current, which your customers gladly provide the moment they turn the switch on. It requires conductive materials, ionic materials, which can be the residues from flux and can also be the usual suspect residues. And normally it is the totality of them both. It also requires moisture. And when I say moisture, I don't mean a board floating in the ballast of a ship or a submarine or in down an oil well in Houston. It can just be humidity from the atmosphere. Parasitic leakage is a devil. It really is. A parasitic leakage is a reduction of resistivity, not enough to create a short, but enough to alter the performance of the assembly. So parasitic leakage, its most common symptom is it drains the battery on a board. If your assembly is backed up by a battery or operated by a battery or some kind of remote power source that's temporary, the parasitic leakage will frequently result in rapid battery drain, among other things. But the problem, the good thing and the bad thing is it's only temporary. It's only a temporary problem. Unlike dendritic growth, which creates shorts, which is a more of a permanent damage, parasitic leakage is a temporary phenomenon. It only occurs when the conditions are perfect. So, for example, in a higher humidity environment or an environment that contains quite a bit of moisture, like this platform here in off the Gulf, any electronic assembly within that environment is going to be subjected to more moisture and more harsh environment salts and things like that than a board in an Amazon server farm. So the boards that are running product on a platform are less tolerant to residues than other boards might be because they have a great deal of moisture around them to react with those residues. So if the frustrating part of parasitic leakage is the fact that the phenomenon is temporary. So imagine a board, an instrument that has to be calibrated, a very sensitive measurement instrument that runs off of electronics on this platform is malfunctioning. It won't calibrate. So they send it back to the manufacturer, and the manufacturer inspects it in their climate-controlled, humidity-controlled environment, and they get a no-trouble-found response from their automated inspection. We have an acronym for no trouble found, which is WTF. And normally in this environment, when the customer insists something's wrong and the manufacturer cannot verify it, there's actually two sets of acronyms that are generally produced. One is NTF, followed rather rapidly by WTF. I'll let you all figure out what that is. If you're in the test business, you already know. If you're in the electronic assembly industry, you already know. So WTF, NTF, they can't duplicate the problem. Then the board is shipped back to the platform and the problem just comes right back again, which creates this very frustrating cycle of a failure. So everything in life, and in this illustration in the electronic assembly industry, and more specifically in the world of ECM and reliability, is cause and effect. So the cause, moisture combined with electrical current combined with conductive residues, the effect, electrochemical migration. No current, no ECM. No residues, no ECM. No moisture, no ECM. Take any one of those out and the problem goes away. So of the three elements which produce ECM, moisture, current, and residues, as I said, any one of those removed from the equation will prevent the onset of electrochemical migration. So one common theory is to remove the moisture. And how do we remove moisture? Well, a lot of people, if this were a live event, hands would be going up and we say, you know, conformal coat the boards, which is wrong and right all in one. Conformal coating is permeable. And, you know, the Webster's definition of permeable is allowing liquids or gases to pass through it. So the purpose of conformal coating is to prevent a failure if something like this happened. If an iPhone or an Android phone fell into a swimming pool or a toilet, and the boards were conformally coated, then the product would survive if it's removed from the liquid in a certain period of time. If I were to pour my water on my MacBook Pro in front of me, I would hope that the board right below the keys was conformally coated because it would survive. However, moisture will over time permeate through the membrane of conformal coating and can react with anything below the conformal coating, any residues, conductive ionic residues below the conformal coating, and produce an ECM event under the coating. Here's three examples of what I'm saying. Our friends at Foresight provided these images for us. To the left is a component that has been conformally coated, and you can see a dendrite growing right on the surface underneath the coating. Now, keep in mind, no moisture, no ECM, no dendritic growth. So there has to be moisture underneath that coating in order for that dendrite to grow. We also see on the right upper photograph, we see an example of corrosion under conformal coating. Corrosion requires moisture, and that is under the conformal coating. And then finally, on the lower right photograph, we see delamination of the conformal coating. And that occurs because of bad adhesion. And bad adhesion reminds me of this guy. For those of you who are upwards in age like myself, you'll remember this ad, Earl Scheib, "I'll paint any car, any color for $29.95. And how does he do that? He doesn't prep the surface. Or he didn't prep the surface. It was just bring it in, spray paint over whatever is there. And don't worry, if you don't like the color, it'll peel off within a few months and you can go back to your original color. That's what happens if someone tries to conformal coat over residues. There's a very high probability that there will be delamination of that material, as you can see in this photograph right here. So the best practice for conformal coating is to clean the assemblies prior to coating, which creates a circular reasoning. Circular reasoning works because, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So removing moisture, A, is not entirely possible, and B, in order to run the processes that would reduce the amount of moisture, one has to have a clean assembly. So moisture removal is not really the solution to prevent ECM in the long term. Removing the current obviously is not a good solution. It is effective. It is very effective. But then again, your customers are buying your product because they want them to do something. They don't want them to remain off. So that really is a non-starter. The best method, the most effective method for preventing any electrical chemical migration event is to remove the ionic residues. Non-ionic doesn't really matter. We don't care a whole lot about that, although when you remove ionic residues, you generally remove all residues. It's the ionic residues that we are highly concerned about. Now, the final ECM-related event that could lead to a failure is conductive anodic filament, or as I like to say, conductive anodic filament failure, CAFF. This is not a cleaning issue. You cannot clean your way out of CAF. However, you can easily avoid CAF through a number of small steps, or even sometimes just one step, which is not all that costly in for most people. So CAF was first reported in 1976 by Bell Labs. I'd like to think this guy is the guy who worked there, but I don't know that for a fact. I like to call CAF subterranean ECM, subterranean electrochemical migration, because it does not, unlike dendritic growth and parasitic leakage, as I've described earlier, CAF does not occur on the surface of the board. It occurs within the layers of the board. So if we look at a multi-layer board, we have several different layers. There's prepregs, there's all sorts of materials here, and they get pushed together in a hydraulic press, generally, to form one substrate with multiple layers. And after the laminates are all squeezed together and form one surface, most boards have some degree of through holes or vias, and they have to be drilled out. So, or tooling holes, whatever. So the drilling process occurs, and it's possible during the drilling process to create a little bit of drilling damage. And that is little cracks, little micro cracks, emanating out from the through hole or from the via, as a result of the, either the drills being dull or too much pressure put on, or, other factors. And these other factors can include inadequate resin flow, or something that they call dry weave in the board fabrication business. If a board goes through multiple thermal excursions, that can exacerbate these micro cracks, make them bigger, and actually cause them to form in some cases. Either way, whether it's from drilling damage or dry weave or too many trips through an oven, these little cracks can form, which are in on their own not an issue. They're kind of an inert phenomenon. However, other parts of the board fabrication process can exploit those micro cracks. So once we've the boards have been drilled out, these micro cracks have formed. What do we do with the holes? We plate them, and we, in order to plate them, we put plating solution in there. And sometimes that plating solution can exploit these micro cracks and get into the micro cracks and kind of fill the gap with plating solution, which is highly conductive. Once the boards are fabricated and the drilled and plated, they go to the assembler and they go to you guys, and you guys stuff them with components and then turn them on. And once the boards are subjected to electrical current, over time, we could get some CAF formations, filament formations, growing within these microcracks and causing shorts. Now, CAF, the filaments on CAF are very fine. They're not heavy enough gauge to conduct a lot of current, but they do cause boards to malfunction, and that malfunction could be a battery drain. That malfunction could be a calibration error, number of things like that. Sometimes they can actually short themselves out and act like a fuse. And if that occurs, you may never know, or it may damage the board in the process. They rarely cause a fire or anything super dramatic because they just don't carry enough current, but they can take down a product and cause it to not function properly. And once it forms, it cannot be repaired. You can't clean your way out of CAF. That's just not possible because we can't reach the area of the board where the CAF has occurred. So what do we do? Well, fortunately, we can prevent the CAF from forming. Once it forms, it's too late, but we can prevent it from forming altogether. So CAF occurs in two stages. Two things have to happen. Number one, there has to be a degradation of the resin-glass interface, something microcracks that we call microcracks. And then the CAF forms, the filament forms. So once we just get the microcracks, that's not fatal. Baking can prevent further damage because just like ECM on the surface, ECM within the layers requires the same ingredients. It requires electrical current, moisture, and conductive materials. Once the CAF forms, that's fatal. Throw away the board. Unless it burns itself out and doesn't grow back, the board is pretty much toast once it does form. So let's look at what promotes CAF, the CAF promoters. One is microcracks. Inadequate resin flow, dry weave, drilling damage, multiple thermal excursions, that as I mentioned before. Let's look at conductive residues. They're a reality. We, as long as we're going to plate the through holes, the vias, we're going to have to use plating solutions, which will always be, at least in our lifetime, conductive materials. So that's kind of a reality. We can't just not plate the through holes. Because that would have a very significant knock-on effect. Voltage, the higher the voltage, the more CAF potential, but I'm going to throw that into the reality mode. I don't think you can go back and tell your designers to cut your voltage in half. It's the voltage chosen for a particular application is to serve that application. So that's really a reality issue and not really a design issue. Hole-to-hole spacing, I'm going to call that that's a design issue. That can maybe be changed, but it also lands in the world of reality because component packages have fixed spacing. Bottom terminated components, BGAs, have fixed spacing between their conductors. And if 1,000 components have to be put into 5 square inches of space, that is really going to land in the reality world more than the design world. But to some extent, one can design more spacing. To some extent, we're kind of stuck with what we have. Materials are a big one. That's where we can really make a change in attracting a CAF issue or repelling a CAF issue. Robust resin systems and glass finish combinations appear to be the best possible candidates for improving the insulation resistance of the laminate. Whatever laminate material one chooses when making the board can affect the propensity of CAF. Dicey cured epoxy is better than phenolic cured epoxy for CAF resistance. CAF preventative measures, if you want to really avoid the possibility of CAF, via-to-via gap, more gap, less CAF potential. Again, that may not be an available choice, but if it is, the greater the gap, the less CAF potential. The bias, the voltage on the board, the lower the bias, the lower the CAF potential. Again, may not be your choice. Laminate CAF-resistant materials reduce the risk of CAF. There are all sorts of FR4 and other laminate materials that are more CAF-resistant than others. Talk to your board fabrication folks and see if there is, if you're concerned about CAF, see if there is a material with less CAF potential. Cathodic vias have a lower CAF potential versus anodic vias. Again, that may be a reality. It may be a choice. It's up to how your board is designed. Reflow profile, lower peak temperatures in profiles decrease CAF potential. Again, that it's probably not a design issue. That's probably a material selection issue. And baking assemblies reduces the CAF potential a lot. In many cases, it can prevent it. Although keep in mind, you can get all of the moisture out of the assembly before you ship it to your customer. Depending where the board goes, where the product is operated, the climactic environment may reintroduce moisture back into the equation. May not. Just depends on a number of factors. But certainly baking before shipping the product out greatly reduces the propensity for CAF. And when I say baking, most of the experts on CAF suggest 2 hours at 120 degrees C. IPC has a, in the J standard 001 test method 650, 2.6.25 is a CAF test. One can use the IPC specification to design an experiment to determine the propensity of CAF on your particular assembly. That's a little bit of a crystal ball that can see if your board has a greater or lower propensity of CAF. There are also third-party companies. We're not related to these companies, but I know them, and I know that they can perform these services to determine the propensity of CAF based on your board design. You send them the Gerber files or other files, and they can actually tell you the propensity of CAF, which may save a lot of money in the long run. There's great materials available online. My favorite is this one, Conductive Anodic Filament Failure, a Materials Perspective. If you're concerned about CAF, Google this document or email me after this presentation, and I will be happy to send you a copy of this. And it's a good resource for looking ahead to see if you can engineer out CAF as a high potential and make it a very low potential, if a potential at all. So the cause of electrochemical migration on the surface is electrical current combined with conductive residues and moisture. The solution, remove the residues to prevent electrochemical migration, dendritic growth, and parasitic leakage. CAF has a very similar set of requirements and one extra. CAF is caused by the mixture of electrical current, conductive residues, and moisture, just like on the surface. But CAF requires a pathway. On the surface, the whole surface is a pathway. Within the layers of the board, the pathway has to form in the form of microcracks or something similar. So a very similar set of requirements plus pathway. Solution, eliminate the pathways. That's a material selection. There are laminate materials that will not crack under the same stresses that standard FR4 materials might crack under. Eliminate implement calf-resistant designs. And number one, remove moisture. No moisture, no ECM of any sort. To clean or not to clean, as I would like to believe Shakespeare said, you may not have to clean. I'm not saying everyone has to clean. Some people do, some people don't. Who are you in that consideration? Well, number one, know your product. That sounds very elementary, but know your product. Consider your circuit assembly's residue tolerance. Every assembly has a unique tolerance for residue. Some can tolerate a lot of residue. Some can tolerate very little, if any, residue. And what are the factors there? Well, consider your circuit assembly's climactic environment. Is it going to go into an Amazon server farm, or is it going to go into a North Sea oil platform? Clearly, a board in an Amazon server farm has a much greater tolerance for residue because it's going to see less moisture than one on a North Sea oil platform. People talk about harsh environments, safe environments. They are really becoming more mixed. And you know, what is a harsh environment? Well, it's relative, as I would like to think Einstein would have said. It's completely relative. It depends on the residue tolerance of the assembly. So we look at illustrations like this as definitions of harsh environment, the poster child of harsh environment, an unpressurized part of an aircraft going from minus 50 to plus 100 cycled many times a day, or a submarine, or a lighthouse, or a satellite, or a oil platform, or a downhole, or whatever. Those are all classic harsh environment scenarios.
But for some assemblies, an office space could be considered a harsh environment.
So consider the component spacing. The illustration above shows a through-hole component with, relatively speaking, miles of space between conductors. The illustration below that is a very high-density board. You can barely see the laminate material. It's all almost completely populated with components, with conductors very, very close together. So the board above would have a much higher residue tolerance than the board below, which would have a very low residue tolerance. Consider the standoff height. Flux and other materials can be trapped underneath these bottom terminated components, which may or may not be bad, depends on a number of other factors. But clearly, the amount of residue tolerance is lower on the board with a number of bottom terminated components and high density fine pitch components compared to the large towering cans with great spaces down below. That board has a much higher propensity for residues without creating an ECM event. And most importantly, consider what the cost of failure is. In some cases, the failure is planned obsolescence. That is a legitimate strategy of design. But look at the cost of failure. This electronic flea collar does have a cost of failure. If it fails, we have one itchy dog. If the implantable defibrillator or pacemaker fails, we may have a different cost of failure, which is a trip in an ambulance or worse. So each of these products have a completely different cost of failure. So one would say the concern over residue and the ECM-related symptoms of residues may be greater on the pacemaker than it would be on the electronic flea collar. So know your product, know what its residue tolerance is, consider its end-use climactic environment, where is it going, consider its cost of failure, itchy dog or trip in an ambulance, consider its component density, consider its component standoff height, know how clean enough. Now, I don't have slides on this, but we will be in one of the upcoming podcasts, on Reliability Matters podcast, we will be discussing the new IPC cleanliness testing standards, particularly relevant to ROSE testing. ROSE testing has been for the last 50 years the go-to for determining how clean is clean. However, it doesn't determine how clean is clean enough. The number assigned to Rose testing results was 10 micrograms of sodium equivalent per square inch, or 1.56 per centimeter squared. And those numbers were established in the 1970s when pretty much every board, well, I think all boards back then were through-hole with a high level of residue tolerance. Today, with miniaturization and the examples that I've shown earlier of lower residue tolerance designs, that number is no good anymore. So the test is good, just the number is good. So really, it's how clean is clean enough? IPC's new J standard on cleaning now allows the user to come up with objective evidence. So you can design whatever test you want, or you can use a pre-existing Rose tester or whatever, and you can use that. You just have to show that the numbers that your test or the Rose test is producing result in a board with a high degree of reliability. And you have to show that those numbers mean something. So we throw away the old numbers and we adopt new numbers based on objective evidence. And we're going to get into that in another webinar. Probably our next webinar will be that next month. And we'll also do that in a podcast. So stay tuned. In the world of Internet of Things, wearables, Industry 4.0, the move to lead-free, the move to no clean, the move to high density, super miniaturization, very low standoff heights, and increased quality expectations, we have propelled electrical devices into environments where they were not normally found. We're putting smart meters on homes, and these smart meters are located outside. We're putting electronics in refrigerators. We're putting cameras and Wi-Fi devices in refrigerators to make them connected. We're putting connected technology in toothbrushes, in prescription lids to know how many times the prescription bottle was opened, be able to track that remotely. We're putting these devices into footballs and tennis rackets and basketballs. And we are taking products that had not normally been associated with electronics and putting electronics in there and then throwing them out into all sorts of environments, environments with weather for the smart meter, environments with cold and moisture in the case of refrigerators, environments with moisture and shock in the case of toothbrushes, and shock in the case of football and tennis and basketball. And we are expecting these products to operate without fail in an environment where we've not had that experience before. We just had the Super Bowl the other day, and I'm thinking of these RFID, not RFID, but these little transmitters that they're putting inside footballs. And for reasons I don't understand, but they are. And football is, you know, the kind of the definition of harsh environment in terms of shock and in terms of moisture and heat and cold, and generally not heat, but certainly cold. And these devices have to operate. I don't know what the cost of failure is. It may be rather low, but certainly reputation is a cost, and most people don't want their products to fail, even if they don't cause a lot of damage. When we look at automotive electronics, you know, we are driving a computer that happens to be mounted on a car, and a lot of the electronics we're putting into cars are not just infotainment, but they are actually designed to keep us safe. So if we're driving a Tesla in, you know, with autopilot turned on, we need to know that the electronic assemblies in this car, which can go in and out of harsh environments, be subject to vibration and cold and moisture and heat, are reliable because our life could depend on it. I have a couple of cars. My weekend car is this 1968 Mustang. It has one set of electronics in it, and that is in the AM transistor radio that's built into the dash. That's pretty much the only electronics in the car. There's electrical systems in the car, but if my electronics fail, I can't listen to AM radio. That is the worst thing that'll happen to me. I also have another car that is completely glass cockpit and high tech. It has adaptive cruise control. It will turn my steering wheel and park for me if I want it to park for me, parallel park, for example. It will bump me into the center of my lane. It'll actually grab my wheel and turn it to keep me from drifting out of a lane. There's a lot of electronics in that car that are designed to keep me safe. And if they fail, they could hurt me or worse. So, you know, the standard is very high on reliability when it comes to circuit assemblies, particularly exaggerated when they're put into harsh environments. So reliability really does matter in these cases, and we can increase the reliability by simply removing the residues and eliminating one potential cause of failure. So harsh environment, safe environment, they're becoming blurred lines. It really depends upon the assembly's ability to withstand residues and their cost of failure. So finally, last few slides. Thanks for sticking with me. Finally, if you've been on my presentations before, I always end with this because this just remains my favorite anecdote. We have a customer who manufactures high-end equipment for the music industry, amplifiers and speakers and all sorts of stuff. And they've been around for a long time, and as they went from tubes to solid state, from through-hole to surface mount, they began to notice a degradation in the quality of the sound coming out of their speakers. And they had a feeling that it had to do with contamination on the assembly, which it did. So they sent us boards to clean, and we offered to provide cleanliness testing to quantify the amount of contaminant before and after, which is normally desired. In their case, though, they didn't really care about what the numbers said. They were ahead of their time, actually. They didn't care about what the numbers said. They wanted to know, if they remove residue, what does the quality of the sound sound like? So their version of cleanliness testing was this. They basically brought a bunch of musicians in a sound booth and jammed for a while, and they listened to the quality of the sound coming out of their speakers, and they could determine how clean the board was by the quality of the sound being produced through those boards. And that is what I like to call their sound of clean. So in the world of risk, reliability associated with risk, we have several choices. We can reduce the risk. We can transfer the risk. We typically transfer the risk when we send a product to a contract manufacturer and say, this is your problem. You need to build this right. We can accept the risk and just say, okay, that's just part of business. Maybe planned obsolescence would be a good acceptance risk policy. Or we can avoid the risk. And my proposition is to avoid the risk, eliminate the risk, just eliminate one of the three variables that produces that risk, either electrical current or moisture or residues. And residues, of course, makes the most sense out of those three. If you remove the residues, you remove the risk. There may be 1,000 other things that kill that board, but it won't be electrochemical migration. You can take that off the table if the residues are removed, the ionic residues are removed. So to finalize, know your product, know its residue tolerance, know its end-use climactic environment, know its cost of failure, and know how clean is clean enough. In other words, know your sound of clean. So whether it comes to harsh environments or safe environments, clean matters.
Well, that's another episode. Thanks for listening to Reliability Matters. If you like what you hear, please be sure to give us a like. Just click the like or heart button below. If there are any reliability-based questions you'd like to have answered or specific topics discussed, let me know. I can be reached at mike@mikeconrad.com. That's Conrad with a K. Don't miss another episode. Subscribe to Reliability Matters on iTunes or follow us on Spotify. You can also listen to us on iTunes, Spotify, AqueousTech.com, PCBChat.com, Spreaker.com, or our newest affiliate, Ascendo Reliability, on reliability.fm, a site dedicated to all things reliability. Once again, thanks for listening. We'll be back soon with another episode of Reliability Matters. In the meantime, keep doing it right.